There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Once again, glad that you've joined us here for a little conversation about some classic cardboard. And as we all gather around the table, let me tell you a tale. Just a few weeks ago, my son turned 11 years old. And that in and of itself is just mind-boggling. If you have kids, you know what I'm talking about. It's kind of a cliche where people say, oh, it feels like I just brought him home yesterday from the hospital. And that happens pretty much every day with my kids, but especially on their birthday. So my son recently turned 11. My daughter just turned 5 yesterday. And it is true. It seems like just yesterday you just brought them home and now they're all big, and especially with an 11-year-old boy, bigger, almost as big as you, smelly, hormones raging. And we're really getting excited for the teenage years and middle school. But it's because of the upcoming middle school. My son is in this particular position right now, wrapping up elementary school. 5th grade, big man on campus. All the other kids, the youngsters, they're all minions to the 5th graders, right? You started in kindergarten, you worked your way up. You're at the top, baby. 5th grade. The head honcho, the big cheese. Numero uno, and other names that William Shatner dropped into his dialogue in Airplane 2. And even though my son is a really good student, really popular, and also, you know, very well educated, and my wife and I, we really harp on, you know, getting a good education. And even though he is a good student, he does get that occasional waft of big man on campus syndrome, where he just pisses and moans about having to go to school. Oh, I don't want to do this test. I don't want to get on the bus. I don't want to this. I don't want to that. Blah, 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 blah. And part of the big man on campus syndrome that he's getting now is the assumption that, you know, you're at the top of the heap here, you're in 5th grade, the learning stops, right? And boy, is he in for a rude awakening when he starts middle school next year. But I've often had to tell him, I've had to say, listen, you know, the learning doesn't stop with school. You know, when you graduate from high school, guess what? You're probably going to go to college and you're going to learn there. And when you graduate from college, guess what? You're going to be in the real business world and you're going to learn there. And you may even go on to another level of college education, you know, like your old man is right now taking graduate school studies, you know, working on a master's degree. So here I am, 43 years old. I'm still learning from a textbook and a college professor. And of course, those of us who are old enough, we realize that even if you're in elementary school, you're still learning outside of the classroom. You're always learning. And that's a good thing. Nobody ever knows everything. Nobody should ever claim to know the answers to everything. You should always have an open mind and be ready to learn, sometimes the hard way, on how things are done. So you can imagine my delight when, a couple months ago, I'm surfing around on eBay trying to find some products to purchase and bring on to the show, have some great memories of growing up with some of these baseball cards that we open up here and talk about and get to learn a little more about the players that are involved. And I saw this item that I had never seen before. And maybe it just wasn't on display at my local hobby shop 30 plus years ago. Maybe it was, and I just didn't pay attention to it. But I saw it, I liked it, and I thought this would be a fun thing to dive into a little bit and certainly make you aware of it if you aren't already. It is the 1990 Topps Heads Up collection. And this is an interesting collection for a number of reasons. First of all, it's an interesting product. A 3x5 blown up picture of your favorite ball players' heads. So it's this giant floating head of some of the big stars of Major League Baseball in 1990. And it's also an interesting collection because when you look at the checklist, it's really not the biggest stars of 1990. There are a handful on this 24 player checklist where you look at it and you go, all right, Topps was stretching here. And that's no offense to the players who we will name later, because let's be honest, they've played more Major League Baseball games than you or I have. And as I like to say on this program, there's common cards, but there are no common players. And that is certainly the truth here with the handful of players that make up the lackluster finish to this checklist. But that's exactly what it is, a rather lackluster finish when you look at some of the other names that were featured on this product. But the 1990 Topps Heads Up collection is something that is readily available, even though it is 31 years old, and relatively affordable. So this is something that if you wanted to collect, much like a lot of the early 1990 stuff we've been diving into recently, if you want to collect it and have a unique collection of miniature heads without all the voodoo magic required to do the real thing, then this is a fun set for you that won't set you back a lot and will certainly remember or recall for you some great names of Major League Baseball in the early 1990s and a few that may not have been great, but they were playing baseball in the early 1990s. So we will talk about the 1990 Topps Heads Up set in this episode. We had three packages, so we get three players. So we'll do a brief biography of these three players, which you know many of them fairly well. All pitchers, by the way. And you can see the video of the pack break on our YouTube channel, which will be getting modified over the next several weeks, by the way. That is the fruits of me paying lots of money to take the classes for that marketing master's degree. I'm learning some more ins and outs of YouTube. So you'll see some subtle and not so subtle changes to the YouTube channel over the next few weeks once I have some time to do it. But if you go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1990 Topps Heads Up Break, you will see me, first of all, lampooning the checklist and then opening them up and having some fun with these giant floating heads of Dennis Eckersley, Jim Abbott, and Greg Olson. So check that out if you haven't already. You can also find the link on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. Speaking of the Twitter timeline, we opened it up a few days ago to listener questions, a little listener mailbag, since this particular product is not something that you can really go in length on. And again, just three player bios that opens up a little time. So we'll talk some listener fan mail after we discuss the product and the players, then we'll get into that. So got some great questions too, just some general hobby interest questions that we'll address, and including a pretty interesting what about question about a company that has become synonymous with trading cards over the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years. And we had somebody wondering, you know, what would this company be like if it was around in the junk wax era? And I'll go ahead and kind of put on my what about hat and go ahead and try to prognosticate on what that would have been like. So we'll take care of the listener mailbag before we wrap things up here. And it's going to be just a little bit of a different show, but a fun one as we look back at a very unique product in the Topps Heads Up We look back at three very interesting player stories, and we look at your questions and comments as well. Now, questions, comments, show suggestions, always welcome to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. Had some people sharing some pictures of their cards, including the 82 Tops Tom Brunansky rookie card, which I have. I had that. I think that was one of the cards that I pilfered from my older brother. He had a stack of 82 Tops cards, and I ended up with that over time. And, you know, an interesting collection of the Andrew Ridgelys on that card. You got to check that out to see some of the not so familiar, or in one case, familiar in legal court documents names. And I'll leave you to explore that if you're wanting to see what that's all about. And also, you know, a lot of people joining in, following along at Wax and Gum Stains, following the YouTube channel. Thank you for joining Wax Ecstatic. We do come your way every other Friday. So our next podcast will be coming on Friday, February the 12th. And that'll be our last look at the early 1990s Donruss packs. 1994 Donruss will be the next couple of packs that we open up and dissect and kind of reminisce about. So make sure you join us for that, as I will try to rack my brain as to how many 94 Donruss baseball cards I had. Probably not many. I've said before that I may have collected more 94, 95 Donruss hockey cards than baseball cards, believe it or not. So I'll explain why in that particular show. Also, be on the lookout. A couple of topics that we're working on. Thanks to some donations of some cards, and I really, really appreciate that, especially JP Peters sending a couple of update and rookie sets. So I've got 88 Tops update and a 92 Pinnacle rookies set, I believe it is. Thank you for sending that along with my 87 Tops set, the 91 Donruss rookie set, and the a handful of 76 and 81 Tops traded cards. We will, in a future show, maybe not necessarily right after the 94 Donruss show, but in a future show, we'll take a look back at the update sets, update traded, rookies, all of those set extensions that came about first out of necessity in the 1970s, and then out of just product innovation, starting with Tops in the early 1980s, Fleer and Donruss very quickly adapting that in the mid-80s, and of course, Upper Deck extending it with the upper or high number series in 1989. So we'll take a look at the history of the traded and update cards a little later on in the run of the program. Also, you will be very pleased, at least I'm thinking you'll be very pleased. Let's just say I hope you are very pleased. We are working on getting an interview with the guys at Repacked Wax. Yes, Repacked Wax. You know what that is. That is the effort of several card collectors to collect vintage cards that are in good condition, or I shouldn't say in good condition, better than good condition, and basically repacking these cards into vintage wax packs. And they are selling like hotcakes. This was a product that came out a couple years ago, and collectors very quickly jumped on the Repacked Wax because not only is it just a collection of vintage cards, but there are some real gem cards that are out there, some legitimate high dollar cards. And that's one reason why the price point on some of these packs is a little higher than some people may want to spend. But I think it is well worth the effort if you spend your money and you're just itching to open up some wax and pull out some cards from the 1960s and 70s. And perhaps maybe you get a Willie Mays card or Willie McCovey or Hank Aaron, God rest his soul. Maybe you're getting you know, some notable name, some league leader card, or even if it's just the thrill of opening up a handful of packs that have cards that are, you know, over 35, 40 years of age, it's a fun thing to do. So we're going to get into the backstory of how Repacked Wax came about, how the business is going, And also, I'm curious, how are they trying to get around the hoarders? Because that's the bad side. Of course, there's always a bad side to the card collecting hobby and industry, isn't there? You have the hoarders, the people, the speculators who buy these products in mass and then sit on them for a while and then re-release them and try to profit off of it. Very similar to the great 52 Topps pack race. Remember those boxes? Came out about 10 years ago, I want to say. And, it's just the collection of wax packs that go out there with some vintage packs inserted in randomly. And, some people, unfortunately, they would buy cases of them, store them away, and then now you're seeing them pop up once again. And for much higher than the 20 or 30 bucks they were being sold for back in the day, going 200, 300 bucks just on that idea that perhaps you can get a vintage pack. So, we'll ask the repacked guys about, how they're trying to avoid having the hoarders in the hobby try to sit on this stuff and basically take the product away from collectors who are just itching to open up some vintage wax product. Now, I've also had some suggestions for some cards from the 1970s, so we'll see what we can pull off the eBay searches. Also, some of the big releases from Topps in the late 70s and early 80s through Burger King and Kmart and Squirt, so I've got my eye out on some of those. And, of course, just some random sets that get dropped in every now and then. So definitely keep your eye out for the 94 Donruss show that is coming up next. And then we will have shows with the repacked wax guys, as well as taking a look at the history of the traded and update and high number sets that came out throughout the 1980s, as well as the other stuff that I can just find while shopping around over the next few months. Now, if you would like to help Wax Ecstatic, you could do so in one of two ways. You can make a cardboard donation. So just like I said, JP donating a couple of traded sets. Thank you very much again, JP. He reached out to me and you can too. My email is mattsammonsays@gmail.com. That's mattsammonsays@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking. If it's a product that we can showcase on the show, we'll do it. If you just want to add to my own personal collection, you're more than welcome to do that too. I just ask you, please reach out to me and let me know what you're thinking you're sending. And don't just dump cards on my lap. That has happened before. Certainly don't want just piles and piles of cards showing up. But, thanks again to listeners like Mark Skoback, who sent a handful of vintage cards that may one day inspire a show. At the very least, it allows for me and my son to have some entertaining throwback baseball cards to talk about. I'm wondering how big were Don Mossy's ears, so you can do a cardboard donation. That's totally fine. Just email me ahead of time. Let me know what you're thinking, as well as how I can reciprocate. Are there cards that can go back to you? Do you want me to cover shipping and handling? Or is this just a 100% donation in kind? Whatever works for you works for me. Now, also, if you would like to make a cash donation, you could do so via PayPal. PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. And again, Wax Ecstatic is all one word there. PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. Donations that are small by standard, $5, $10, they go a very long way in helping out the show, not only keeping our show on Audio Boom, which hosts the program as well as sends it out to all the other podcast platforms and also keeps our archives free and available to download if you wish. But it also helps us purchase those products. And again, I'm somebody who's very thrifty. So $5 or $10 goes a very long way with this show. And don't forget, if I ever have excess product of any kind, it all gets stored away in boxes and then eventually gets shipped off to our friends at Commons for Kids. And you can follow them on Twitter, Commons, the number 4 Kids. They are collecting common sports and non-sports cards. Please send them something in great shape. Don't just send your bubblegum stained 1988 Topps cards to them, okay? Send them some cards that are in great condition. Send them some current stuff. Send them some junk wax stuff. Send them some vintage stuff. They do a great job of collecting those cards, sorting them, and donating them to kids who are just having trouble in life right now. Maybe it's an economic situation with the family. Maybe it's a bad family situation. Maybe it's a medical crisis that the child is going through right now. Divert them from all the crappy stuff that's going on in life with a handful of cards of their favorite team, their favorite player, their favorite sport, and also just help keep the hobby getting into the hands of kids. We all know that cards are very expensive these days. I'm reading reports that 2021 Topps cards are already, you know, pre-sale prices are through the roof, which I think is a little ridiculous. This is something that, you know, in fact, in a future show, we may bring up with our old friend Nick Nianti. We'll probably do another one of those Topps Heritage, this time 1972 Topps crossover shows. We'll bring Nick on to talk about the new products. This could be something that is a danger sign for the hobby, where you've got pre-sale prices going through the roof. And again, you're excluding kids as well as just low-income collectors. And there's still quite a few people that collect just for the hell of it and not because they think they're going to magically turn a card around and sell it for $25,000. But I digress, because the hobby is out of reach for many kids. Comments for Kids, great way to get the cards in their hands. And like I said before, get their mind off of whatever nonsense is going on in their lives. So donations to Wax Ecstatic, be it cardboard or cash, go a long way to the website and the podcast, to the products that we discuss on this show, you know, obtaining them if I have to buy them, and passing them along to needy kids through Commons for Kids. So please, if you have a way to help out in any way with the program, we certainly appreciate all efforts to do so. Now let's talk a little bit about 1990 Topps Heads Up. Like I said, I had no idea that this product was around in 1990. I had no idea it ever existed up until several weeks ago when I saw it on eBay and I purchased them. And I think they're pretty neat products, and I completely understand why Topps created it, what they were trying to accomplish, and also why it was so short-lived. There is only one official set of Topps Heads Up, and that's from 1990. Now, there was a prototype, a test set that was released in 1989, which is worth a lot of money if you can find it, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But with Topps Heads Up, like I said, this was a 3-inch by 5-inch floating head. This was in many ways a predecessor to the Fat Head line of products. Remember those? Those are big, probably about 15 years ago. And you had those giant life-size wall decals. And it was mostly football players, but then you had, you know, different sports came in. And then on top of, you know, the athletes themselves, just team logos. And Fathead came out, and it was a smashing success because it was a very unique piece of sports fandom. But it was also one of those Phil commercials, I believe, on ESPN for many, many years. Very quickly nudged the Tom Amansky baseball videos aside a little bit and Fred McGriff's big puffy blue hat. And you saw ad nauseum 10, 15 years ago, these Fat Head commercials. And then you had people with actual fat heads like Ben Roethlisberger selling his fat head. Not his actual fat head, the fat head product. And it kind of got comical for a little bit, but it was a very smart product because it was affordable. It wasn't permanent. You could always peel it off and move it to another wall somewhere. And then it also changed size. And I've seen, in fact, my son's bought a lot of these over the years, these mini fat heads, just these static wall clings of hockey and basketball and baseball. And like I said, team logos too. It's great branding of not only, you know, teams, but also the players. It's a really smart and somewhat portable and affordable collectible. A little better than a baseball card in the sense that it's bigger and you always get a star player with these things. So, you know, those are the plus sides to the fat head. The downside, of course, is, you know, what if you buy one of somebody who just totally flames out? And case in point, when I was working at a sports talk station in Tampa, Florida, 15 years ago, we got a fat head of a Tampa Bay Buccaneers player. Who was it? Was it Mike Allstott? Was it Warren Sapp? Was it Brad Johnson or Derek Brooks or even Martin Gramatica? No, it was Carnell Cadillac Williams, who, you know, his career flamed out after about 3 or 4 years. So, you know, you buy this thing for $30 or $40 and now you've got this former player taking up an awful lot of room on your wall, and you just don't have the heart to peel it off and throw it out because you spent so much money on it. And you can't really resell that on eBay, can you? How do you ship that? That's just going to be a little tough. So, you know, there were some downsides to it, but, you know, the fathead craze, which again has splintered off throughout the years, still pretty popular. And I see the Topps Heads Up as kind of an early attempt at the fathead product. Now, this isn't the first time that a player's likeness has been presented in a different way within baseball card packaging or from a baseball card company. You've had posters, you've had cloth stickers, you've had coins, bottle tops. I mean, all sorts of different ways of taking a photo or a likeness of a player and presenting it in a unique way. And it's not the only time that a baseball card company like Topps branched out from the base product. Like I said before, they used to print up cards for co-op partners in Kmart and Coca-Cola and Hostess. And, you know, you had all of these different cards and products come out over the years. So the Topps Heads Up wasn't exactly groundbreaking. But when you think of the times, 1990, it was very, very different, and especially coming from the Topps company. And it was a pretty interesting offshoot from the base set because that was the big thing that was still being pushed in 1990. And not just with Topps, this was with everybody. Upper Deck, Donruss, Fleer, Score, Bowman, they were all pushing the base sets. Now, base sets were changing. You still had the continuation of the rookie card craze, which had built up in the early to mid 80s. But you also had insert mania. You had autograph cards getting put in there. This was right before the dawn of gold foil on everything and then UV coating on everything, even at the very cusp of the beginning of the premium sets. You know, the Leaf set came out in 1990. That was really one of the first extensions of a base brand that had a premium look to it. So in 1990, you're still very much dealing with just standard, simple baseball card sets. That was it. Not too many bells and whistles. So Topps decided to go out on a limb here and try to sell floating heads of these popular ball players. And it was part of their strategy that they had been going on for a few years here. And I think it kind of branches off of the Topps Big Set, which was still going on in 1990, although it was a shell of itself from its 1988 debut. You had the Topps All-Star Sticker Set that was still going out. You had the Topps Europe set. And I know it's often referred to as UK minis, but as I've pointed out on this program, the cards were actually produced in Ireland, which, as those of us with Irish blood will tell you, is not part of the United Kingdom. Thank you very much. So I refer to the Topps UK mini sets of the late 80s as Topps European sets. And Topps was branching out in the late 1980s, and not only just to try out new products, but again to separate themselves from the competition. And, you know, having something that Fleer didn't have, having something that Donruss didn't have, and certainly not having something that the upstart and very classy high price point Upper Deck had. So you had to branch out and have all of these different items. And I think that's what Topps Heads Up was. It was a completely different item going for a very niche audience. And who is that audience? Well, pretty much, I'd say, mostly boys between the age of, say, 8 and 15. And I'm sure there are some girls that perhaps would have liked to have a floating head of their favorite ball player. But this was clearly designed mostly for prepubescent boys. If you look at the wrapper of these Topps Heads Up packages. It shows kind of in a cartoon drawing on the cover, a school locker with a few of these floating heads suction cupped to the locker door. And that is definitely something that would appeal to somebody in, say, the sixth or seventh or eighth grade. You had that school locker. You were supposed to decorate it. Some people did, others didn't. And what cooler thing to decorate it with than the floating head of Ken Griffey Jr., you know, one of the biggest young stars of the game at that time. Or if you're a Yankees fan, Don Mattingly was one of the players that was featured in this set. So how cool would that be, right? And even if you didn't have a locker, you didn't feel like decorating your locker, well, instead of suction cupping this thing to a locker, you could peel the adhesive tape off on the back and slap it on your bedroom wall or a door or a mirror. You know, if you want Kevin Mitchell looking back at you in the mirror like a crazed ex-boyfriend. Well, perhaps Kevin Mitchell was like that to some people. I don't know. Certainly, if you had cats, you definitely wanted to keep the Kevin Mitchell face away from your bathroom mirror. That will provide some PTSD to your feline friends. So this was definitely appealing to somebody who was around 8, 10, maybe 12 years old, maybe a little older, maybe a little younger, but generally speaking, in that range. And it was just another way to have a picture of your hero or heroes or favorite team wherever you went. So not just did you have your baseball card collection or maybe a poster or two or a pennant or two hanging up in your bedroom. Now you can have the 3-inch by 5-inch cardboard head floating around of your favorite player or team. It's a very simple creation for Topps, very inexpensive. You only had one face that went into each pack. You only had 24 packs in each box. So assuming that you didn't have any duplicates in a box, you could basically complete the entire set if you bought a whole box. And it was a pretty, you know, neat, fun kind of offshoot product here that you had in addition to your base set. And that was Topps marketing strategy for many years. I remember having a box of 1991 Topps, and or maybe it was 92. It was 91 or 92 Topps, where I bought it from a local card shop, brought it home, opened it up, and inside not only did I have the 36 packs of cards, but I also had a small promotional poster that Topps put in there to encourage the retailer, that was who they thought they were selling this to, not some pimply-faced 15-year-old kid, but to encourage the retailer to stock up on multiple Topps products, not just the, you know, Topps baseball cards, but also the Bazooka Joe bubblegum. Here you can get the complete factory set of Topps baseball cards. And, here's this new candy, you know, like Push Pops or, you know, whatever the Topps chewing gum company was pushing out at that time. So you had, you know, this little promotional poster pushing 6 or 7 other items. So it was very smart of Topps to diversify off of their base product. And that was kind of the standard again in the early 1990s. But then, much like what put the kibosh on the Topps European set, also brought the death knell to the Topps big cards, less of an emphasis on, you know, the Topps stickers. It was how the competition went through, you know, a whole new level, starting with premium cards. Again, you have Upper Deck that set the bar. Leaf had a premium set, so Topps had to go out and make one. Fleer had one, an Ultra coming out in 1991. So when you had to diversify sets, it was creating a premium set. It was upgrading your base set to look and feel like a premium set. And in some cases, such as Donruss and even Topps tried this, maybe making a set of cards geared towards kids. You have the Topps kids cards, the Donruss triple play cards in the early 1990s. So kind of these fun off-the-wall products like big cards and, you know, the 3D all-star cards that Donruss had in the mid-80s. You know, all of these other just kind of goofy things, the UK cards They all very quickly fell by the wayside by 1991 because companies like Topps wanted to refocus on how they were diversifying their product. Also, don't forget, 1990 into 1991, the United States came in through a pretty big recession that lasted through the early 90s. Country didn't really pull out of it or start pulling out of it until around 1994. And that's not a coincidence that Topps was also, you know, coming back with the Topps mini set, and miniature cards were all the rage once again. You used to get miniature cards in Cracker Jack packages. So again, looking to save money, kind of like Topps did in 1975 when they created the mini set. You saw miniature sets and some smaller size products that were coming out, focusing more on the quality than the quantity, just to save a few bucks. And it was a catch-22 for Topps as well as the other card makers at the time, because the hobby was exploding. People were investing in it. You had to stay on top of it and invest in those products while also trying not to go bankrupt. Well, we all know how that worked out, as many of those card companies started going belly up and started bailing out in the mid-1990s when the hobby got a little too bloated for everyone's comfort. So you can see why this product was created. You could see why it only lasted 1 year, and you know why it got shelved so quickly. It was just an unfortunate timing, and maybe it fell flat with its intended audience. And I could totally see that, considering at that time you had six major card sets. You had Topps, you had Bowman, Fleer, Donruss, Upper Deck, and Score all at the same time. Well, now here comes Leaf. Here come the premium sets. If you were a baseball fan and you collected baseball cards, you wanted baseball cards, not a big head of your favorite player just kind of collecting dust on a desk or the back of a bedroom door or something like that. So maybe it did miss the target just a little bit. But it is a unique throwback here. And when you look at the checklist of the players, it's actually, generally speaking, a pretty impressive group of players, or at least the first 20 of them are. So you start off with players like Bo Jackson, Craig Biggio, Dwight Gooden, as I mentioned, Don Mattingly, other young stars like Gary Sheffield was in there, Jose Canseco, you had Griffey, and then you had, you know, the three players that I pulled, Jim Abbott, Dennis Eckersley, and Greg Olson. You know, people forget Greg Olson was a huge star, a young rising relief pitcher at that time. You also had Tony Gwynn, Mark McGwire, Kirby Puckett, I mean, just a whole slew of names. But then you get down near the bottom of the checklist, and it starts with Tom Gordon, who was a, you know, relief pitcher with the Kansas City Royals at the time. Okay, well, there's Tom Gordon. And then you go on down, and there's Dwight Smith and Jerome Walton and Craig Worthington. And again, they've played far more baseball games than you or I ever have, but they're not exactly Ken Griffey Jr. and Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire. This was, and I mentioned this in the video, this is kind of like when you were in school and you had to put in a 10-page book report, and you had enough material for 8 pages, and then you're just really fluffing the rest to get to 10. I think that's what happened with Topps here. They had, you know, 19 or 20 really good, notable players. And then they're like, oh, crap, we got to come up with 24. Well, nobody else has given us the allowance to use their likeness. And Jerome Walton, yeah. Okay. So, you know, that was kind of the downside to that collection there. But for the most part, a pretty interesting and suitable collection of all-stars and young rookies. Now, something else that is standing out for the heads up, like I said, there was a 1989 version that was a prototype version. So it was released in smaller numbers. It was released to very specific markets, and it was full of all-star players. You didn't have the Dwight Smith and Jerome Waltons. You actually had a very, very good all-star lineup of players here. And because it is a smaller amount of cards, or not cards, I'm sorry, faces that were produced, and because You know, these were some limited numbers and limited markets and some all-star players. The value of these, if you can get them, are actually quite high. In fact, the biggest one, of course, is Ken Griffey Jr. That was his rookie year in 1989. And you can see some pretty lofty prices for some of these in the hundreds and thousands of them. In fact, a quick look at some PSA auction prices in 2017, a Ken Griffey Jr. 1989 heads up went for $4,600. Now, that's the extreme high end. I've seen some other prices a little more reasonable if you consider between, you know, $600 and $900 reasonable. But for those heads up heads that were preserved and that also was able to, you know, get tested or graded and was rated a PSA 9, that got some pretty big dollar amounts. So I've also seen the bidding just for some 1989 boxes going for, and this is in past auctions, I should mention, going for several hundred dollars. So, you know, this is something where if you can get your hands on the 1989 ones, it may cost you a few bucks, but depending on what's inside those wrappers, could get you a ton back. So don't expect that in 1990. However, I have seen some price listings for these basically averaging about $1.50, $2 each. Maybe you get, you know, $3 for the Ken Griffey Jr., but Topps saw enough promise in 1989 to roll out a full complete product line in 1990. Didn't quite meet expectations and or was a victim of kind of the restructuring of what Topps was diversifying their product with, as well as the economic challenges of the time, and that folded up the shop there. So if you magically find some 1989 Topps heads up, go ahead, get those graded because they're going to be worth something. If you find some 1990, just open them up and collect them. Try to stick them to a wall. The adhesive, not as good all these years later. And the suction cups, just as reliable as the bubble gum in some of the equally old packs of Topps baseball cards. So that's just our look at something fun, something fleeting. And, you know, maybe you're not really all that interested in it, but if you're one of those collectors who goes for something beyond the standard baseball card, Topps Heads Up is definitely one of those things. It does not cost a lot. The three I got, including shipping, was like $9. So, you know, again, I think I paid more for shipping than the actual product. I think I paid maybe $2 for a pack. But you can find them relatively easy on eBay. And perhaps this is one of those items kind of like the Topps big cards and, you know, some of the other junk wax era releases, not only from Topps, but other card companies. You may actually find this in the bargain bin at your local card shop or at a card show. This is one of those products that a dealer, because he has no idea what to do with them, may just give them to you. So if you look around a little bit, you can find the 1990 Topps Heads Up without too much fanfare, but also with some pretty notable names on the checklist. And Tom Gordon and Jerome, and, yeah, you know, the guy's picking up the last few spots on the checklist. My apologies to Craig Worthington. All right, let's take a look real quickly before we do the listener mailbag and get to some interesting questions of yours. Let's take a look at the three players that I did pull from the pack here, including the most notable of the three, Dennis Eckersley, the Oakland, California native. Now, he had no idea he would actually pitch for the Oakland A's, but certainly was able to make a name for himself and kind of reinvent himself with Oakland in the late 1980s. But let's start with 1954, as Dennis Lee Eckersley was born to Wallace and Bernice Eckersley. And he was a standout at Washington High School in Fremont, California. Such a standout. He was a third round draft selection of the Cleveland Indians in 1972. Works his way up through the Cleveland farm system very quickly, and also very quickly wins over new manager Frank Robinson. Spring training 1975, Robinson loves Dennis Eckersley. And if you think of the 75 Cleveland Indians, even as a youngster, even as a 21-year-old rookie, Dennis Eckersley was still probably better than half of the Indians' pitching staff at that time. Well, Robinson had some trouble convincing general manager Phil Seggy, as well as the Indians' ownership, to keep Eckersley on the major league roster coming right out of spring training. And that is how Eckersley actually started in the bullpen. The only way Robinson could keep him was to start him out in the pen. And like I said, the Indians' pitching staff was not that good. So by the end of May 1975, he would work his way into the starting rotation. In fact, made his first start in Cleveland against the then defending and, in fact, three-time champion Oakland Athletics, May 25th. 1975. What does the freshman ball player do? He only allows three hits, strikes out six, and defeats the A's 6-0. Not too shabby. And he continues to make a name for himself in the Indians rotation, not just in 1975, but nearly 2 years to the day later, May 30th, 1977, pitches a epic no-hitter against Frank Tanana and the California Angels, was named an all-star for the Indians in 1977, and even at the young age of 23, seems to have a bright future in Major League Baseball. But that bright future is not in Cleveland. Boy, many ball players could say that, couldn't they? The one knock against Eckersley was he had a tendency to give up a lot of home runs. And the management didn't like it. They didn't like his tendency to give up the long ball. They didn't like his style of delivery. You know, he had a high leg kick. And they just weren't quite sure what to do with this guy. So what do the Cleveland Indians do? Well, they trade him away to a contender. This is why the Indians haven't won a World Series since 1948. Boy, and they still keep making those mistakes. Francisco Lindor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Indians decide to trade him to Boston March 30th, 1978. They send Eckersley and catcher Fred Kendall to the Red Sox for Rick Wise, Mike Paxton, Ted Cox, and Bo Diaz. Well, that worked out well for everybody. So he is immediately welcomed into the Red Sox clubhouse. Manager Don Zimmer loves him, and Red Sox fans do as well. In fact, he went 20-8 for the Red Sox in 1978 with a 2.99 earned run average that season, of course, coming down to the playoff game against the Yankees, the Bucky Dent game, as we all know so well, in October of 1978. He would continue to be a very successful pitcher in Boston, even though he had a few rough spots here and there, was still overall a very effective starting pitcher. But again, the long ball starts to haunt him a little bit, and the Red Sox decide to move him before he somehow loses his value. So after the 1981 season, after he gives up 142 home runs in five full seasons with the Red Sox decide to move him to the Chicago Cubs, and they traded Eckersley and infielder Mike Brumley to the Cubs for some guy named Bill Buckner. Boy, he would factor into the Red Sox history, wouldn't he? So Eckersley goes to the Cubs, and he, along with other former Cleveland Indian Rick Sutcliffe, would create a pretty solid 1-2 punch in the starting rotation for the Cubs as they won or they got into the playoffs for the first time since 1945 in that 84 season. Unfortunately for Eckersley, he starts dealing with some shoulder injuries, some tendonitis in his arm, and he struggles with some rough 1985 and 1986 seasons. And after the 1986 season, he gets dealt to the Oakland Athletics. Now, he goes to Oakland, where Tony La Russa is trying to build up a juggernaut of a team, and he has no idea, Eckersley, of what's going to happen here. And La Russa throws Eckersley into the bullpen, and basically he became the closer by default when Jay Howell, who at the start of the 1987 season was supposed to be the closer, developed some injuries, so Eckersley takes over. And he would never let go. Of course, he had to deal with the ignominy of giving up the Kirk Gibson home run in the 1988 World Series. But he would be a world champion in 1989 with the A's, be a key part to contending teams, American League champions in 1990, American League West Winners in 1992, a contending team in 91 as well, just fell short of the Twins, rather. And going to 1992, accuracy with 51 saves and an incredible 1.91 earned run average, not only wins the Cy Young Award for the American League, but also the Most Valuable Player Award. And he would continue to be a dominant closer in Oakland in 1993, 94, and 95. Walked very few hitters, was a very dominant guy. He either grounded out, flew out, or struck out. He was not a guy that issued too many free passes. Now, after the 1995 season, Tony La Russa would leave, go to St. Louis, and Eckersley would follow him after 1996. So he goes to St. Louis from Oakland in 1996 and plays for the Cardinals for a couple of seasons, finishes up his career with the Boston Red Sox in 1998. 390 career saves, 1,071 games pitched, and an invitation to Cooperstown. He was inducted in the Hall of Fame in the summer of 2004. Now, he is a studio analyst for NESM, and he is also doing some work for MLB Network every now and then, and he's a bit of a red ass. He is a guy who does not hold back on his commentary, tends to be seen as a grumpy old man at some times, has had numerous clashes with Red Sox players, most notably David Price in past years, of course, Price with the Dodgers now, but Eckersley is not a guy to hide his emotions or his thoughts. Not quite as abrasive as a guy like Goose Gossage is. I think Goose has some other things going on besides just hating on ball players these days. But definitely Dennis Eckersley, a guy who is not one to mess around with. He will not pull any punches along the way. Now, from a guy who went between bullpen and starting rotation and found success at both ends of the pitching staff, we go to a guy who was, at a very young age, determined was not going to be a big star. Now, that's what others were saying. This guy, however, had other ideas. We're talking about Jim Abbott, who is still an inspiration to a lot of people, not just children, but adults, and not just people with disabilities, but also people who have just been told you can't make it, because a lot of people doubted Jim Abbott along the way. Jim Abbott was born in Flint, Michigan, September 1967, born with a deformed right arm. Basically, he has no right hand. The arm stopped developing right around where the wrist is. And his parents, when they saw Jim was a toddler and getting interested in sports, naturally thinking of protecting Jim, go, okay, we're going to find a sport that he can play that doesn't involve his hands. So they buy him a soccer ball. They try to get him involved in soccer. Jim doesn't like soccer. He's growing more accustomed to baseball. So give some credit to Jim Abbott's father, who decided to work with Jim as a youngster, helping him bouncing a ball with his left hand off a wall and positioning himself to catch that ball with the left hand on the rebound. Also, Jim's dad showed him how to make that transition, wearing the left-handed glove on that right wrist nub, if you will, and after throwing the ball, making that transition of getting the glove back on his left hand. Jim's father, by the way, Mike Abbott, I should mention, worked two jobs at the time, sold cars, was also a meat packer, and you know, really worked hard with Jim on perfecting this craft. And it started paying off here, as Jim Abbott was not only a good pitcher, but also had some pretty good hand-eye coordination that was being developed along the way. Now, a very interesting story here, and this comes from Rick Swain from the Society for American Baseball Research. I think this is quite the way of establishing yourself. When Jim Abbott was 11 years old, he joined a Little League team, and the first game he pitched, a no-hitter. Not too shabby. So while this was certainly a good way to establish his young playing career, a lot of people understandably thought, well, this is nice, but he's not going to succeed. Well, that was definitely not the case. He started playing baseball for Flint Central and was not only a good pitcher, but also a good fielder. Even with bunts, he was able to just toss the glove aside and just pick up the ball bare hand with his left hand and throw it to first base to get the out. He was also, believe it or not, the backup quarterback for the Flint Central High School football team. He actually started the last three games of his senior season, passing for 600 yards and six touchdowns. He was also featured on the NFL Today pregame show on NBC. So this would have been, what, the 1980-1981 football season. I wonder if that video is still floating around somewhere. Now, he gets the attention of the Toronto Blue Jays, actually drafts him out of high school in the final round of the draft. That was the 36th round, offered a $50,000 bonus. However, Abbott turns that down so that he could attend the University of Michigan. And believe it or not, despite the fact that he's doing pretty good as a baseball player, despite this deformity, he's not really heavily recruited. So Michigan is basically the one school that's giving him a chance, and it would absolutely pay off. In fact, he was able to help the Wolverines in 1987, finish first place in the Big Ten Eastern Division standings. They would also go on to win the conference championship. He threw a shutout in the NCAA baseball tournament, had an 11-3 record, and also in 1988, he was named the Big Ten Conference Player of the Year, the first baseball player ever to be named for that award. And of course, in 1988, also getting the honor of his lifetime, pitching with the United States baseball team, the Olympic team in Japan, a gold medal effort, which was awesome. Now, after he picks up that gold medal, he decides to pass up on his senior year at Michigan and get into Major League Baseball. So he is drafted not in the final round of the draft. No, the California Angels jump on him in the first round with the eighth pick, and he's able to negotiate a bonus of $207,000. Nice little uptick there from what he had a few years before from the Toronto Blue Jays. So Jim Abbott would become one of the first players to go directly from the collegiate ranks right into Major League Baseball. He did not start in the minor leagues. Had a little bit of a rough start, first couple of games in the 1989 season, but by the end of the season is able to win over a lot of fans and a lot of respect in the major leagues. In fact, he was able to win a lot of games for the Angels, a talented but underwhelming team the Angels were at that time. Abbott goes 12-12 that first season. Like I said, wins a lot of respect from people. He was named the club's Rookie of the Year, also the most inspirational player by the Anaheim chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. So you can imagine going into 1990 when this heads up picture was taken and distributed. Boy, the world is his oyster, right? Well, things would fall apart a little bit, and not necessarily because of anything Abbott did, but because the Angels were starting to fall apart. This very good contending team of the early to mid 80s were just always a few pieces shy of having a contending team, most often offensively. There were a lot of seasons where Abbott had really good seasons had some good pitching outings, but he just didn't have the run support. 1990 goes 10-14, rebounds in 1991 after losing his first four starts, goes 18-11 that year, finishes with a 2.89 earned run average. But again, lack of run support. 1992, it rears its ugly head as despite many losses, Abbott went 7-15 that year. He had a 2.77 earned run average. So again, more of an indication that the Angels were a disaster and not Jim Abbott. Now, the Angels were not able to come up with a good deal, good contract for him. So they decided to trade him to the New York Yankees for three minor league prospects. Now, the Yankees were suddenly in all-star rebuild mode here. They'd gone out and acquired Paul O'Neill. They had Jimmy Key, Wade Boggs. So why not bring in Jim Abbott, right? Well, here's a team that can give him some run support. As much as Abbott did his best, in fact, no-hit the Cleveland Indians in September of 1993, he had a really rough go with the Yankees, mostly in part to George Steinbrenner, who thought he was overpaying this guy. Steinbrenner actually claimed that Abbott was suffering because he was spending too much time doing charity work. Well, that's a big assumption. That's not real friendly. So struggling in 1993 and 1994, the Yankees decide not to pick up the option on the 1995 season. So he becomes a free agent, signs with the Chicago White Sox. The White Sox, after they fall out of contention, trade him to the Angels, where he again finds his magic touch and helps the Angels in their playoff run late in the season. And in 1996, he had just signed a new deal with the Angels, a three-year contract, but had a really terrible 1996 season. And the Angels just not willing to take the risk of having a guy who in 96 had a 2-18 record and a 7.48 earned run average. They decide just to eat his contract and make him a free agent. So he goes through the comeback route again. And for the first time in his career, Jim Abbott has to play in the minor leagues. And he eventually works his way up through the Chicago White Sox system back to Chicago, where he wins all five of his starts late in the season. White Sox weren't completely sold on him. He's still making money from the California Angels, or the Anaheim Angels at this time. So Abbott then signs with the Milwaukee Brewers, does not do extremely well in the 1999 season, but does have a noteworthy note in history. Noteworthy note that was very note-ish, I hope you noted. But he has an interesting moment. In June of 1999, he finally gets a chance to bat. You know, think about it. All this time, he had been in the American League. Well, by 1999, the Brewers had moved over to the National League. So June 15th, 1999, he lines out to a first baseman, and that's it. But he would be the first player in over 50 years since Pete Gray, the one-armed ball player for the St. Louis Browns in 1945, he would become the first one-armed ball player to have an at-bat in the major league. So that's an interesting little footnote there. Now, he would be released by Milwaukee in 2000 and retired from baseball. As you can imagine, Jim Abbott is still very, very popular, and not because of his stats. 87-108, a 4.28 earned run average, or 4.25 earned run average, excuse me, but still a very, very inspirational, very much in demand for public speaking, and a great example of somebody who was told over and over again, well, you're pretty good, but you might get swallowed up in the system, or you're going to get bypassed by other people. But Jim Abbott was able to turn those doubts first with a no-hitter in his Little League debut. I still can't get over that. But also a lot of Big Ten honors with Michigan, a gold medal in 1988, a no-hitter in 1993, and a pretty productive career and a pretty good way to set an example for many people in 11 years with Major League Baseball. Last but certainly not least, another ball player who defied a lot of obstacles along the way. His career was very much dead in the water. That would be Greg Olson, who was an absolute stud when he came into the major leagues in 1988, but had to find his way through the wilderness to kind of resurrect his career and get one last gasp at not only regular playing time, but also a big contract. Greg Olson, born October 1966 in Scribner, Nebraska, quickly soon moved to Omaha, where Greg's father was the coach, or a coach, I should say, at Northwest High School. But with his father constantly coaching on the ball fields, that's where Greg was. And he not only excelled at baseball, but also played football and basketball. Now, Greg would join his father at Northwest High School. And over the next 4 years, the team won four Class A state championships. Greg had a record of 27-0 and an earned run average of only 0.76. He struck out 276 batters. Good enough notes to get a mention in Sports Illustrated's Faces in the Crowd. Remember that little feature in Sports Illustrated? So yeah, he was starting to be seen back in the early 1980s. It was quite a run for Greg Olson and the Northwest team, as they were pointed out nationally. They were getting honors throughout the early 80s. And in 1985, he was offered a football scholarship at the University of Nebraska. However, decided to go the college baseball route. And where did you go to play college baseball if you were any good in the 1980s? You went to Auburn. And coming from an Alabama alum, that's high praise there. Yeah, think about Auburn. You had Frank Thomas. You had Bo Jackson. You better believe it. If you're Greg Olson, you're going to that factory of major league ball players. In his first year as a member of the Auburn Tigers, he made 14 starts, appeared in a few other games as a relief pitcher, 7-3 record, and basically became the Tigers' closer after struggling a little bit as a starter, and he certainly was able to set the tone for the rest of his career at that point in time. He was drafted by the Baltimore Orioles in the first round, fourth overall at that time, the highest pick ever for a college relief pitcher, and he would also try to play for that 1988 Olympic team with Jim Abbott. Unfortunately for Greg Olson, he contracted mono. He wasn't able to take part in the whole series there, so he came up just a little short of living that dream. But his dreams would come true as a member of the Orioles system, as he fast-tracked his way up to the big league club in September of 1988 when he made his big league debut. And by 1989, he basically planted his flag in becoming the closer for Frank Robinson's Baltimore Orioles. And he would be an absolute star pitcher for the Orioles for the next few years. 27 saves in 1989, 37 in 1990. He was an all-star that year. 31 in 1991, 36 in 1992, and 29 in 1993. Now, Olson in 1993 started having some arm discomfort. In fact, had some ligament damage. It was rumored that he might have to have Tommy John surgery, but he opted not to. Actually consulted with Nolan Ryan's doctors, and fortunately for Olson, the ligament damage healed itself. Unfortunately for Olson, he was never the same. In fact, you talk about walking in the wilderness. Here's what he was doing over the next few years. 1994, he signs with Atlanta. Has a 9.20 earned run average in 16 games. Then the journey continues. 1995, plays for Cleveland and Kansas City. 1996, Detroit and Houston. 1997, Minnesota and Kansas City. Finally, with the expansion Arizona Diamondbacks, he lands in 1998 and finally stays in the city for more than one season. And why not? 1998, 3.01 earned run average, 64 games he appeared in, 30 saves. He's back to his old self, has a pretty good follow-up season with the Diamondbacks in 1999, decides at the age of 33 to test free agency, signs a big contract with the LA Dodgers, and implodes. Yeah, does not have a very good 41-game experience over the next couple of years. The Dodgers cut him loose, and that wraps up Olson's major league career. But a very interesting tale of a kid that was unstoppable in high school and college and goes almost directly to the major leagues, has a pretty impressive start with Baltimore, but then has to find his way to get into the good realms of bullpen pitching once again. And he was able to do that with Arizona in the late 1990s. Now, ever since his retirement, he has moved on to several jobs, including being an advanced scout for the San Diego Padres. He has also been a part owner and president of Toolshed Sports International, one of those companies that makes high-performance athletic undergear, so kind of think Under Armour. And he is also proud to have a child of his, Brett, a right-handed pitcher, who was a infielder for Auburn just a few years ago. He is still much loved in his home state of Nebraska and has even co-edited and contributed several stories to the book We Got to Play Baseball, 60 Stories for Men Who Play the Game. Of course, he contributes his own story as well. So there you go. A quick look-see at the three players who were part of the 1990 Topps Heads Up packs that we opened up here on Wax Ecstatic. All right, let's take a quick trip to the listener mailbag before we wrap up the program. Some great questions and comments that were brought up on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains recently. So let me open up the mailbag here. One of our newest listeners, Golden Hurricane Card Sales. This is an interesting what about question here. How would a company like Panini have fared during the junk wax era? Would it have survived like Topps or fallen by the wayside like Fleer and score? Well, it's a very interesting question. And if you actually look at the history of Panini, that will offer you somewhat of a roadmap of if Panini got into the game, say in the early to mid 80s, how they would have fared. And the short answer is probably not that good. And Panini started in the 1960s. There, it was a couple of brothers in Italy, the Panini brothers, and they stumbled upon a collection of figurines that the manufacturer couldn't sell, so they sold it, and all of a sudden they're in the collectibles business. In 1970, they struck a deal with FIFA to create yearbook stickers in conjunction with World Cup soccer. And that would be the Panini claim to fame. Every 4 years, they would produce these stickers for the yearbook collectibles, which are still extremely popular and a fun collectible, by the way. My son and I did that back in 2014 when the World Cup was in Brazil. And it was fun to collect those little stickers and you know, put them in the books and learn a little bit about soccer players in their native countries. So that was Panini's claim to fame up until recently. I don't think they make those stickers anymore. But you know, that was their run for what, 40, 45 years. And then they got into the trading card industry as they have, you know, resurrected the Donruss name and some other throwback look and feel cards. I don't really collect anything Panini, even though they do have you know, some interesting products that are out there. I'm just not big into what they offer these days. But again, if you look at the history, it actually kind of dovetails with almost what Fleer's history was. You know, Fleer started in the late 50s, and we talked about this, you know, in our podcast on 63 Fleer not that long ago. And while Fleer was a lot more direct and aggressive and challenging Topps in the 60s and 70s, eventually opening the door in 1981, Panini wasn't. They didn't really get into the hobby until, like I said, about 10 or 12 years ago. And this is how the junk wax what about path crosses with the reality path. To answer your question on what would have happened, basically seeing how Panini got almost the same start as Fleer. Had Panini started in 1981 when Fleer got the okay to create officially licensed baseball cards, let's essentially replace Donruss with Panini, because that's essentially what would have happened. You would have had probably the same path. They would have stumbled out of the gate. They would have come up with some good products over the years, but then by the early to mid-90s, they just would have absolutely been swallowed up. And I'm not sure that Panini was in a place or could have been in a place in the mid-90s to increase product quality, product diversification without losing their ass. And, you know, that's what happened with all those other companies. Now, Fleer was still making baseball cards until the early 2000s, but clearly just, you know, kind of lost their path, as did so many other card companies in the mid 90s. So I think in that situation, Panini probably would have fallen by the wayside like Fleer and Skor, like you mentioned. But the reality path that they took by not being part of the baseball card craze in the 70s and 80s and sticking to what they knew best, which were those World Cup sticker albums, they have become kind of a vulture in the industry. So are they like Topps? Well, no. Topps was always the strongest of the companies. They had the most, you talk about product diversification, they had the most assets to where even through restructurings and bankruptcies and going through, you know, private sales to, you know, the group that they're owned by now, the Topps product was always going to be the strongest. And that's why Topps survived. And, you know, to an extent, the arms that Topps has now, you know, Bowman and the Turkey Red cards and all that. So Topps was always going to be the strongest, but what Panini has done by letting Donruss and Fleer and Skor and all these other brands go away, Panini was able to scoop in on the Donruss brand and you know, was able to, like a vulture, kind of pick on the carcass of what was left and, you know, provide nutrients for itself along the way. So it's an interesting mix. What would have happened with Panini? Well, had they gone the same route that many car companies did back then, they probably would not have survived. But what's interesting is with all these other companies not surviving, they basically survived by picking on the carcasses and what was left. So thank you very much, Golden Hurricane Card Sales, for that question. Josh Fennell, do you think digital cards have a future with a new generation of collectors regarding Topps Bunt app, or will the hobby forever be tied to an affinity for material, culture, and nostalgia? That's a great question, Josh, and I think when it comes to anything digital, and this has been the topic of conversation for several years now, ever since Bunt came around, but also with the Topps Living set, with the Topps Now cards that are created, just kind of spur of the moment, in the moment card creation, you can buy that card, have it shipped to you. There is always a need for digital, current, living, brand new. There's always a market for that. But there is also always a market for the nostalgia, the physical cards. And that's what you're seeing now. Again, thanks to the pandemic and people just trying to find something to do with their free time, you're seeing that 90s nostalgia, that desire to open up a pack of cards and to hold a stack of cards. It's come back, and it's come back with quite the vengeance. And again, hopefully the keepers of the hobby don't screw this up over the next few years. But people want to hold cards. And in a world that is increasingly more digital, not just baseball cards, but just everything, there are more and more people that want to physically hold something. Whether it's a baseball card or if it's an actual document or if it's a picture. Just look at music. You know, you can stream any song you want on Apple. You can listen to any song you want on YouTube, but they're still selling vinyl records. And I saw the news a few months ago that for the first time since like 1986 or whatever, vinyl records actually outsold CDs. Now, people hardly have CDs, but the whole reason why CDs were so popular is because it was CD quality audio. It was digital audio. No more pops and cracks and snaps of vinyl. But vinyl made a comeback, first in clubs and indie record stores 15, 20 years ago, but now in the mainstream. So even though you could listen to the Beatles' White Album in its entirety online, some people, they're still willing to spend $30 or $40 to get a, you know, revised edition of these classic albums and listen to them. So will Bunt, will the Living set, will Topps Now, will there be an audience for it? Absolutely. And even though I'm not a big fan of any of those offerings, I think it fits a much needed, you know, hole. It fills it. You know, in the hobby. And that is, some people want new stuff always. That's how the Living set is. And it's designed by, you know, with the 1953 look. So, you know, you always will have a product with the Living set. You'll always have some current event with the Now set. You want Bernie Sanders all huddled up with his mittens? There's a Topps Now baseball card for that. And it's very popular. And, you know, if you prefer having a digital collection as opposed to carting around box after box after box, Bunt is all for you. But as I sit here in my studio here and I see a big box of baseball cards in front of me, and I know there's a closet that's got boxes of baseball cards, including I've completed the 85 and 86 top sets. Thank you very much for those who contributed to that. There's still a need for people to hold on to that stuff. And I know one day I'm going to move and, you know, I'll probably be in advance of the rest of my family. I'll probably be the one that lands a job somewhere that needs to find the home. So I've got to, you know, leave my family for a few days and, you know, find a house and, you know, hook up the electricity and all that other stuff. I can tell you with the things that I pack on that first car ride, not only the clothes and the necessities of my life, but there will be most, if not all, of my baseball card collection will come with me because there's that personal bond to it. And I think regardless of what digital items come out, there will always be a need to hold on to the physical cards and look at them. So I think there will be a balance. Think of it, Josh, think of it as, you know, the evolution of television. You know, you had broadcast television, and then when cable came around, oh, antenna TV is going to die. No, it's still there. And, you know, when satellite television came by, oh, cable's going to die. No, satellite and cable and antenna coexisted. And then, you know, now you've got streaming services up. Cable's going to die. Well, no, the cable company is becoming more of an internet provider than a cable operator. But there are still people that want that cable bundle. There are still people that still have that satellite on their roof. There are still people that have those rabbit ears. And why not? Because of HDTV, you know, you get 20 or so channels without having to pay for cable. You know, if you're okay with what TV networks and, you know, the HD networks are, which are often old TV shows and movies, you know, if you're okay with that offering, you're not too picky, it's still there. So, you know, 40 years ago when cable started penetrating homes more and more often and people were predicting the demise of broadcast television, no, they're all still there. They're all still coexisting. Same thing with radio. You know, there's still AM and FM radio and satellite radio and podcast and streaming audio. It's still all there. They're still coexisting. And the movie system, Hollywood's going to find out how well home streaming and movie theaters can coexist in how you release films here. So there's always a way. I won't call it a happy medium, but there's always a way to balance all of those items. All right, lastly, I've got two questions here that pretty much dovetail each other. They kind of touch on the same topic here. PK Steinberg, do you PC any players? I'm assuming personally collect any players. And Brian Krauss, what card or cards do you most valuable, means the most to you? So both of you, I believe, are getting towards the value of a card that one, or the value that one places on a card, the sentimental value. So first, PK Steinberg, do I personally collect any players? Not anymore, but I once did. My favorite ball player, Dave Steeb. I still have all of his major release cards from 1980, his rookie card, through the end of his career, 1993. Now that's the first career. I'm assuming, and you know, I don't know this. I guess I'll learn something else. I've got to see if there's a card created for his return attempt back in 1998, I think it was. I'm sure there was, because it was quite a big to-do. You know, he was off the radar for about 4 years before making a comeback attempt with the Blue Jays. So I still have those cards. Like I said, major release cards. I don't think I had any classic cards. Maybe I do. I don't remember. I still have them somewhere. I haven't looked at them in a while. I didn't have, you know, I didn't kill myself to find, you know, a Dave Steeb 1987 Drake's card, you know, assuming the Drake's baked goods made one. But you catch my drift. I wasn't able to unearth all of them. I did find quite a few that were not just standard base sets. But I have every Topps, Fleer, Donruss, Score, Bowman, Upper Deck card that was created from 1980 through 1993. And then if I had, you know, a stadium club or a triple play or any of the other cards, then I did get those. So yes, I did back in the day, 30 years ago, I was collecting Dave Steeb cards. I still have them. And I don't personally collect any individual player now, but I did back then. And then to answer Brian's questions, what cards do I value the most? You know, that's not an easy question to answer because, you know, I don't have quite as large of a collection as I used to, Brian, but I still have a lot of cards that mean something to me. And the collection has grown over the years, but I'm still trying to keep away from the days where I had 50,000 cards and I didn't know what to do with them. So to answer your question on cards I value the most, just off the top of my head, yes, the Dave Steeb collection I still have. I have an 82 Donruss Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card. And that was the first big card I ever pulled from a pack. And I've told this story before, but this was back around 1990. I was at the hobby shop. They had a few older boxes. 82 Donruss was there. I remember buying two packs. They were $5 a piece. So it was $10 total. That was a big amount of money for me as a 13-year-old. And I remember in one pack, I pulled a Nolan Ryan card. The other pack, I pulled the Ripken card. I was stunned. The kid behind the counter was stunned. And I took it home and I put it in a plastic top loader about 25 years ago. I moved it to one of those screw down holders. Even though the value of the card has gone down, I remember back when I was a teenager, it was around $65, $70. It's probably down to about $25 now. Ungraded book value. And I'm sure if I got it graded, it would be a PSA 7 or 8 or something like that. And yeah, I could probably sell it for a couple $100. But that is one of my favorites simply because that was the first big card that I pulled. Not one of those cards that you pull, stick in a box, the player becomes good. 2 or 3 years later, you discover it. Oh, this is worth $10. You know, I had a few of those, but no, this was the first big wax fresh pull that I had, plus from a vintage pack. It was kind of cool. So there's that. Another card that I have, I think I mentioned this in our show about 91 Topps Archives, a Eddie Matthews card that I sent off to him to get autographed, and he sent it back to me signed, and he did this probably about 6 months before he died. And I actually sent him, when I got the card back, I was so moved that he bothered to sign it. I actually sent him a thank you note because I never thought Eddie Matthews would actually sign it, but he did. So, you know, that's still a prized possession. Also, speaking of autographs, I have a couple of Jose Canseco autographs, a few cards from Texas Rangers teams from the early 1990s. Where I value those because my Boy Scout troop, we used to do the color guard ceremony at a Rangers spring training game when they used to train in Port Charlotte, Florida. And, you know, we were able to hang around with the players and their families and, you know, get some players' autographs. It was very cool. So, Kevin Brown, I've told that story. Listen to my 89 Donruss podcast for the Kevin Brown autograph story. Bobby Valentine, where I learned that Bobby Valentine kind of sounds like Kermit the Frog a little. And who else? You know, some other Rangers ball players. But Jose Canseco was one. I helped Jose Canseco inadvertently get some tail that night, I'm sure. And he hasn't thanked me since, because here I am in my Boy Scout uniform with a couple of my troop mates. And Jose is chatting to a couple of young things, probably mid-20s, possibly Hispanic. They had slightly darkened skin, and they were very attractive. I recall I was 15 or 16 at the time. They were very attractive young women. And, you know, I came up and, you know, excuse me, Mr. Canseco, I have a few Boy Scouts here. They'd like your autograph. Do you mind giving them? Well, sure. And he signed my cards and a couple of the other cards. And then he went back talking to the other girls. So, you know, I think I've told that story before, but if Jose Canseco got some action the night that a Boy Scout asked him to sign some cards for him and his troop mates, you're welcome. So, you know, those are some autograph cards that stand out, but also what's been kind of my passion recently, and I've talked about this too, is completing sets, the hand collated sets from my childhood. All Tops, you know, I'm not going to try to do Fleer and Donruss from those years, but I've been able to complete now 85 through 91, and I'm closing in on 84. I'm getting closer to my birth year, 77. And, you know, once I start wrapping up these, I'm working on 75 and 76, and then I've got to fill the gap. I've got plenty of cards from 78 to 83 that I'm going to try to complete over the next few years. So, you know, that, and I would also say vintage cards. You know, I just love old cards, even if they're beat up, even if they're commons. You know, give me a stack of cards from the 60s and I'll put them in plastic pages and look at them and share them with my son. So that's a long-winded answer to some of my personal favorites. So I would summarize it as the first big pull that I had from a wax pack, the handful of autograph cards that I collected when I was a teenager, and then just some completed sets. You know, a 1988 top set is not going to sell much on the market, but I don't want to. I've spent the time and money to put the 88 set together, and it's part of a bigger and growing collection of sets from my youth. So that's kind of fun. So thanks everybody to your questions. Even though we featured a listener mailbag in this particular episode, your questions, comments, show suggestions, always welcome on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, that'll wrap up our look at the 1990 Topps Heads Up product, which again is affordable, relatively available, pretty fun, a quick little thing to collect. And who knows, maybe you'll have a floating head of your favorite ball player from when you were a kid getting added to your collection. Our next program, Friday, February 12th, I'll look back at 1994 Donruss. We'll do that. And don't forget, upcoming shows include the look at the repacked wax product. We'll take a look back at traded and update sets, how they came about. And as I pondered earlier, you can bet sometime within the next couple of months, we'll take a look at the new Topps Heritage cards, which will throw back to 1972 Topps. So we'll look at the 21 Topps Heritage and the 72 Topps sets. Compare and contrast. We'll reach out to our good friend Nick D'Unti to talk about the Topps products. And we'll see, as those Topps regular cards come out over the next few weeks, we'll see if the average man can go out and buy some, or the average child can go out and buy some, or if the hoarders and the speculators are going to jump on them and hold us all hostage. I hope that is not the situation, but I guess we'll find out over the next few weeks. Thanks again for your time. Thanks for your donations, cash donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic, or make your cardboard donation. Let me know what you're thinking at Matt Salmon Says. That's SAMMONSEZ at gmail.com. And who knows where the show goes over the next few months, but you will certainly be a part of it. I am your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. Make sure you keep washing those hands, social distance, wear those masks. Let's together work on defeating this horrible virus. As we wait in these long lines for vaccines, our times will come to get those. But keep doing your part so that we can all gather together and start collecting at the card shows and the card tables like we once did. Let's get back into that by doing our part. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.